He fixed them with a big, goofy doggy grin and eyes like rich pools of melted fudge. It sealed the deal instantly. Hey, how you doing, folks? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am so grateful you tuned in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Kai Lovelace bring us our first story. It's called Where the Good Dogs Go. Rose watched him sleep in the afternoon sunbeam from the back porch, curled peacefully on the linoleum kitchen floor, and her heart broke. The sweet face perched on paws, tucked under the chin, tranquil rise and fall of his back, chocolate brown fur, tinged red under the warmth of the waning light. It was time to make a decision. It was just so unfair. What did he dream about when that pink nose wrinkled and snuffled, paws and tails twitching? She liked to imagine that he dreamt of being a puppy, those golden days when boundless energy propelled him like a rocket, and he slept between her and Brad on the double bed upstairs, not yet confined to the first floor. Back when she still worked in the fertility clinic, before Brad had joined the neighborhood watch, embraced libertarianism, or even heard of Gun Owners of America. Had it really only been a few years ago? She remembered the eyes, above all else, visiting the puppy farm that brisk fall day, seeing them all jostling toward the front of the cage, quivering desperately with joy. Coco, the runt, had somehow clambered to the front of the litter, resting his paws between slats in the kennel and fixing them with a big goofy doggy grin and eyes like rich pools of melted fudge. Oh, it sealed the deal instantly. "That one," they'd said in unison, squeezing each other's shoulders. And they'd been in unison in those days, reading each other's minds, attuned to mutual differences and needs, effortless in their coexistence. The unspoken truth was that bringing Coco home was one more step on the road to parenthood, all the more comforting for its lack of verbalization. The way he dashed through the house that first night, nosing every nook and cranny, tail wagging, trotting room to room to get the lay of the land, casting sheepish glances up at her and Brad. Oh, sure. It had been tough occasionally, lamps crashing at 2 a.m., the time he was left alone for half an hour and managed to use his kennel as a bathroom many times over, tracking and smearing the evidence thoroughly, swearing and laughing as they dealt with the mess, hosing off the dog in the backyard. Brad sterilized every imaginable surface with a zealous devotion Rose teased him about for months. Even then, maternal instinct had outweighed disgust, and she knew quietly that she would be ready for motherhood when the time came. In those days, all it took was a soft, single word, and Coco would flip onto his back, exposing his little pink tummy for scratches that would get his hind legs kicking. The sheer ecstatic vulnerability of that gesture touched Rose profoundly. Her childhood had been stable, but barren. Love and connection, commodities that always came with strings attached. This naked display of unconditional love melted her, made her feel a better future of transcendence was possible. Her home, her husband, her dog, her life. Well, then, like a creeping mist rolling off the bright bay, 3 years passed. The clinic shut down. The job search lagged. a semester at the community college for arts management, passed in a whirlwind, listless attempts at reinvention cycling like tides. Brad's income was solid, but far from spectacular, and the house had been a stretch. But despite the financial strain, she'd gradually begun to focus on herself. Reading, painting, yoga, and most of all, Coco. No matter what happened, he was there, able to intuit her moods quick, to nuzzle his snout against her thigh when she sat against the couch, paralyzed by a panic attack, asking nothing, nothing in return. Thinking back on it, she couldn't pinpoint the exact day when the change occurred, only small signs accumulating over time like droplets of blood leading back to a crime scene of bizarre, elusive motive. Brad always stayed late at work. That wasn't so strange. He had to put in the hours if he was going to make project manager. I don't like it either, hon, but it's an investment. The spontaneous midday texts became more infrequent. Response times to her own check-ins ballooning, tinted with faint annoyance when they finally arrived, or was it her imagination? Possibly. But that's also when the home improvement campaign had begun. First, it was just replacing the vinyl siding on the porch, upgrading the kitchen appliances, putting in the doggy door. Then he got in his head to redo the basement, installing a pool table and arcade games. After that came his obsession with the mid-century modern theme, birthing a dozen other ideas, like if they fenced in the backyard, Coco could roam unsupervised. Was it really a good idea to sink so much in this direction when they were on a budget? Rose brought it up many times, and Brad protested that it was in the interest of building a better home for themselves, another investment. Implication? For our child? She was powerless before this line of reasoning. Brad threw himself into these projects with a passion that reminded Rose of their early courtship in college, single-minded and dedicated. Now the house was perpetually swathed in plastic sheets, tarps laid down on the floors to catch drips of drying paint, lengths of wood and toolboxes left around corners for Rose to trip over. About a year ago, he'd first brought up the idea of the shooting range in the backyard. She thought he was joking. Their patio overlooked a grassy enclosure, 30 acres of woodland spread out beyond. Rose was dismayed the day Brad and Dean arrived with their new toy, a .22 caliber rifle loaded with birdshot, popping cans off stumps of wood and scaring off raccoons, deer, sparrows, and owls. She plugged her ears against the sharp cracks. Is it even legal to shoot that thing back here? Dean threw his brother a teasing grin as he aimed. Well, it's not definitely illegal, depending on county regulations. We're just having a little fun. Besides, there's nobody out here anyway. Only way to hurt someone with this is to get them to point blank. Just wish the darn thing didn't jam so easily. We'll be careful, hon, Brad said, earning an eye roll from Dean. She'd written it off. At least he wasn't a full-fledged gun nut. But where did this come from? She couldn't imagine the shy engineering major from sophomore year at Syracuse brandishing even a BB gun. She had Dean to thank for turning him onto the political broadcasts he left playing while doing housework. Rose's mom had chided her about it over the phone. All men have their hobbies. You think I like hearing about your father's stamps? Just let it run its course. Don't worry. You get so carried away sometimes. Probably right, Rose reflected. She was blowing it out of proportion because of her anxiety, the root cause of which she pondered late at night as she lay next to Brad, snoring away, trying to envision the course of their life together. Somewhere along the line, the unspoken understanding morphed into a kind of gulf. In the harsh light of day, she reprimanded herself. It's just boredom, restlessness. It'll pass once this period of unemployed malaise comes to an end. Just enjoy yourself while you can. Free time, self-care. And Coco, he won't be around forever. Rose used to take the 44 bus to the clinic, waiting alone bright and early at the stop down at the corner of Atherton Road. She grew accustomed to the surrounding landscape during her 3 years of commutes. The rusted trash can attached to the streetlight, the quarry beyond the grassy patch to the left, the copse of woods on the right. In winter, the dirty cotton sky blended perfectly with the soiled snow and obscured the horizon. Cross-hatched by naked branches, then the grill would appear over the hill and break the illusion. In summer, black-eyed Susan swayed with dragonflies whizzing about. The yellow metal seats and forest-green canopy of the structure toasty under the sun. One morning last August, a month before they laid off the support staff, she noticed that the framework wasn't forest green at all. It was aquamarine blue. Had they repainted it? She leaned over and squinted. No, it was filmed in dust and flecked with missing paint chips, like it had always been when it was green, except it never had been. The bus arrived and Rose boarded, but she couldn't shake the sinking feeling that the insignificant detail, the kind that earns a special sense memory in retrospect, could be wrong after all these months. If that was the case, what else in her life was not what it seemed, impermanent, and how long would it be before the next rude awakening? Well, less than a year, as it happened. Once again, it was a gradual process. Coco didn't have as much energy as he once did, but that was only natural as he matured. Did he seem listless, forlorn? Brad didn't think so, but he wasn't paying attention. Then came the accidents in the house. The blood in the stool, hacking crimson wads onto the carpeting. Tired after 10-minute walks, glassy eyes too. A resigned melancholy as tragically selfless as any emotion in that pure soul. Something was wrong, and she had to fix it. The memories of the next few weeks blurred together like fragments of a movie caught half asleep on an airplane ride. Off-white walls, fluorescent stripes in the ceiling, baby blue cushioning on the center table, jars of milk bones and cat treats by the computer monitor. The vet was brisk, chipper, no-nonsense, strawberry blonde hair, pulled in a tight bun and round gold-rimmed glasses. Rose tried to take the news stoically. "I'm sorry," she sputtered. I just never heard of it. It's called intussusception, basically a blockage of the intestine." The information pressed down on Rose's shoulders, draining something she wasn't sure she would ever get back. Meeting Coco's eyes was difficult as they flitted anxiously around the room. Surgery was an option, though a risky one. Considering his slight arrhythmia, the quote elicited a double take. 12,000? Is that normal? Unfortunately, yes. It's an invasive surgery, first to determine the cause and then operate on the obstruction, plus a likelihood of several days in the hospital. Rose was quiet for almost a minute, staring blankly at the summary in her hand. "Ultimately, well, the decision will be up to you," the vet said gently. With effort, Rose replied, "I'll need to discuss it with my husband." Now here she was, and there was Coco zonked out in the golden ray, and they still hadn't really talked about it. Started to, once or twice, arriving at the same precipice, unable to face that final conclusion, as if some delicate truce would crumble in the crossfire. Brad's easy smile always papered over these cracks, an addictively hollow comfort. The pop of a .22 echoed from the patio, jostling Coco out of his slumber and rose from her reverie. Two more shots quickly followed, and Coco laboriously lifted himself and shuffled over to the couch with a minute whine, flopping down against Rose's legs and heaving a sigh. "I know, baby," she whispered. I don't like it either." Coco craned his head, fixing Rose with a lopsided beam, then hacked a coughing sneeze that flapped his cheeks like a sputtering engine. "Handsome little baby," she trilled in a falsetto sing-song, bending down to gather him up for a hug, squeezing tighter until the dog yelped and scrambled away. A flustered minute of rearranging the sofa pillows drained the heat from her cheeks. Brad came in, wiping down the rifle with a rag as he crossed to the basement stairs. She heard boxes rattling around down there, the ritual he went through to secure the weapon on a top shelf, out of reach along with various toxic household items employed in the endless renovations. No chance of any furry friend nosing around up there. When he emerged, he gave a satisfied grunt and said, "What do you think about Chinese tonight? I'm feeling lazy." He noticed her expression and joined her on the couch. "Everything okay?" "We need to talk about Coco." He nodded, solemnly. "Yeah, you're right. I didn't mean to put it off. What are you thinking?" Rose paused, already reading too much into his ambiguous tone. I think we should schedule the surgery, like today. What are you thinking?" Brad rubbed his jaw. "Well, hon, I know this is a tough situation. I agree with you in theory, and I understand how you feel, but..." He trailed off, looking wistfully at Coco. "But," Rose prompted. "Oh, man, honey, 12 grand is a lot, and you said yourself the success rate wasn't great." "It isn't so much when it comes to fixing up your house," Rose said quietly. "That's different," Brad insisted. "Those costs don't come all at once, and that's about making a better life for us here for whenever, you know." "I know, and I admit it was my mistake, too, not getting pet insurance. But now it's too late. We need to do something fast, or..." She couldn't bring herself to say it. Brad shifted closer and stroked her shoulder. "Look, Coco has had a great life. I don't want him to suffer any more than you, but I'm just trying to be, well, reasonable here." Rose fought to keep her lips steady. "Don't say had, okay?" She leaned into her husband, sniffling, who cradled her head and whispered, "Shh, it's okay. Dogs live in a moment, you know? They're not concerned with the future or the past. They just need a good quality of life. If that's not possible, then, well, we need to make things as comfortable as they can be for him, even if that means, well... Rose buried her face in the hollow of Brad's neck. "If we decide on that, it doesn't have to be right away, does it?" "Oh, no, of course not. Although it doesn't seem humane to let it go on forever." She pulled away. "Oh, what do you mean? You think he's in pain now?" Brad gave a guilty shrug. "You know, he doesn't get around like he used to. It's only going to get worse." "So what are you suggesting?" she asked, with an edge. "Take him in today? Put him down?" "I just don't see the point in prolonging things, for Coco's sake." "Well, maybe because I'm not ready." "Hun," he said carefully, "believe me, I get it. But this isn't about you or me. It's about what's best for Coco." Rose blinked in disbelief. You really believe that?" "What do you mean?" Brad asked, frowning. "Nothing, I'm sorry. This is just so hard for me." Of course, it's hard for me too. Is it? Brad hesitated, looking hurt. You know, Rose added, euthanasia is an expense too. They just don't do it for free. His nod was slow, ponderous, as if some curiously off-beaten notion was dawning. Well, that's true. There are other ways. Rose reared back, disengaging from Brad and scooting over on the couch. What does that mean? Brad caught himself eyeing the patio door and looked back quickly. Nothing. What other ways are there? Nothing, honey. I was just coming to terms with everything. The conversation ended there, all but conclusive. Brad went into his home office to send some emails, and Rose tried reading her book club novel, but found no meaning in the words, overcome by an agitated restlessness. I'm going for a walk, she called through the closed door, pulling on her sneakers. Want to come? No, sorry, hon, Brad answered after a beat. I've got some work to do. It was a clear, gorgeous day, though the breeze carried a little bite, promising the first hints of fall. Their driveway led to a broad curve of a road, neighboring houses about 40 yards away in either direction. Rose power walked, fists clenched, ruminating on the point Brad had seemed on the verge of making. Other ways? She recalled the high five when Dean's errant shot had felled a mourning dove. How could he be so calm about the whole thing? She wanted to believe he cared, but it rankled. Oh, a wave of nausea assailed her as she passed the neighbor's single-story colonial. She doubled over with her hands braced on her knees, inhaling and exhaling deeply. Her head spun, and she considered turning back or sitting at the curb, but it began to pass as soon as it had come. It can start this early, she reminded herself, and that was the biggest question of the day, bigger than what to do about Coco. Why hadn't she told him? Was it because she wasn't sure how to feel herself, sitting in the bathroom until her legs tingled, numbly watching the two red stripes appear on the little plastic window? On some level, she was happy, excited to break the news, but something stopped her. It was all too much happening at once. She needed time to process it before taking the plunge because doing so would usher in the next phase of her life and another life in the bargain. There was no rush, one thing and one step at a time, just like this neighborhood stroll. The narrow sidewalk wound in a leisurely loop just under 2 miles, and Rose was rounding the curve, which would put her house out of sight, when the rolling echo of the whip crack carried on the wind. She turned to look back, expecting more shots, but none came. If Brad was blowing off steam in the backyard, he would fire off at least 10 rounds at his tin cans or hanging papers. An absurd thought came to Rose, and her teeth ground. The birdshot was fairly harmless at long range, but up close? 1 round, is it all it would take? No, she thought. It's the old paranoia, acting up because of stress. Finish the walk. Breathe. This is perfectly normal to experience under the circumstances. No one ever said life was easy or fair. Rose decided to take the longer route to the nearby lake, returning almost 2 hours later to a quiet, still house. Dizziness had crept up again, and she cleared the final step, so she went straight upstairs and lay down, exhaustion dropping her into a deep sleep. She awoke, feeling leaden and fuzzy, her head stuffed with steel wool. Daylight was fading in a mauve curtain. Sluggishly, she descended the stairs to the kitchen and was struck by the utter silence in the house. Brad, her voice sounded oddly intrusive, in the evening serenity. Coco, she cooled, then whistled, clicking her tongue and patting her thigh. but heard no scampering of nails on tile or swishing pad on the carpet. She toured the first floor and found nothing. Coco's water dish by the front door, which had long needed replacing, was gone. She checked the pantry, goggling at the empty shelf where the food and treats had been stored. A bubble of panic surged in her chest when she saw the shovel leaning by the patio door, clods of dirt still adhering to its chrome head. The gleaming floor and patio deck smelled sharply of disinfectant. She stood in the door frame as the sun finally slipped below the tree line, bathing the backyard in burnt orange. "Coco!" she yelled again, willing him to come bounding out from the tree line. "Brad!" The emptiness mocked her. "Damn it," she muttered, padding outside. Brown smudges dotted the grass, and she descended the creaking stairs for a closer look. Clumps of dirt lay scattered on the lawn, leading away to the woods. A surreal sensation of crossing a threshold came over her as she followed them. The soil cool and giving under her bare feet, blades of grass tickled her insteps as she pulled her hoodie tighter as the cooling temperatures shivered her shoulders. Darkness enveloped her as she entered the tree line, where a small clearing marked the edge of their property before the terrain became more uneven and heavily wooded. There was just enough light to see by as she stomped and peered down, comprehension dawning, with an excruciating lassitude grappling with denial. The hole was recently dug and messily filled in, about 3 feet by five, where the grass gave way to loose soil and sweet, earthy mulch tamped down. Enough time passed that the last evening light was swallowed, the thrum of insects underscoring her ragged, hitching breaths as moisture eclipsed her vision. She sank into her knees and pushed her hands into the freshly turned earth, racked with sobs. Gradually her moans turned into a low growl, fingers clawing at the dirt of the grave with a smoldering fury that had brewed for months. "Bastard," she whimpered, "lying bastard." Something deep inside her let go, and a weight lifted. She saw herself from above, kneeling on the grass, lit merely from the porch lights. "I'm sorry," she heard herself whisper. "I'm so sorry, sweetie." The hum of the Mazda's motor carried past the house, tires crunching gravel, shrill chirp of locking doors. Brad was home. Rose was sitting on the couch, staring straight ahead when he came in. He threw her a strained glance as he slipped off his shoes. You okay? The forced casualness took her breath away. Am I okay? Seriously? He put his hands on his hips and fidgeted nervously. Yeah, you seem, well, upset or something. Where's Coco, Brad? He's not sleeping somewhere? No, he's not. I can't find him anywhere. Brad crossed his arms and chewed his lip, looking away from his wife's piercing gaze. Oh, he must be out back. A spurt of fury sprung Rose from the couch. That's all you have to say? Do you think I'm stupid? Of course not. I don't believe this. How dare you make a decision like that? It's insane, Brad. Deranged. Brad backpedaled and raised his palms. Honey, we talked about this. I thought we agreed. No, she spat. We didn't agree. How could you do it? His brow furrowed, and he considered his response. We were on the same page, Rose. Rose, don't take this the wrong way, but what is this really about? She wanted to scream, to dig her nails into his face, kick and bite and strike until her life made sense, until it was all back to the way it was before. For the first time ever, she didn't trust herself, feeling completely out of control. It was odd, frightening, but not entirely unpleasant. She strode toward him, and he flinched, thrusting his arms up. The fear and confusion in his eyes was pathetically familiar, and she stopped short. For a strange moment, her thoughts were in disarray, and she loathed herself. Then it hit home again. What he had done, how it must have felt to pull the trigger. The sweet, mournful face past the sighting notch. Once bent round, it was psychotic, inhuman. She didn't know this man. Brad stammered, searching for words that eluded him, and Rose groaned, overwhelmed with grief and rage, shouldering him aside and heading for the front door. He watched her warily, unnerved as she laced up her sneakers and grabbed her keys from the ring. "Wait, come on, let's talk about this," he called as she left, slamming the door hard enough to rattle the embedded glass panes. She was gone for 2 days. Texts, calls, and voicemails piled up unread and ignored. Finally, her phone died, and there was no charger in the Mazda, so she remained alone, disconnected, adrift. Exit signs passed. Honking trucks overtook her. Drivers gesticulating out of the windows. Her eyelids grew heavy, lapses of time consuming her like thick blankets until the ridges at the edge of the road rattled her awake. Night lasted an eternity. A vast sea of blackness. Then the sun peeked over the rim of the world in the rearview mirror. Her fatigue dissipated, transforming into a bone, deep weightlessness, air caressing the hairs at the nape of her neck like water, and hyper-focused vision swimming with writhing shapes, neon hues. Decisiveness was always Brad's strong suit. The neighborhood, the house, the car, who lives and who dies. Rose despised her own passive tendency. Relationships should be built on reciprocation. At some point, she stood pressing the nozzle of the gasoline pump into the tank. A passing couple asked if she was all right. She felt herself nod and respond appropriately, whatever words she used echoing in the chasm of her skull. She didn't eat, didn't drink, didn't sleep, only drove, as if to outpace the inevitable conclusion chasing her down like a bloodhound. But in the end it found her. She pulled off at the next rest stop, washed her face in the grimy bathroom, stared at herself in the mirror for a long time. It was the only decision for herself, for the baby, and for Coco, the only constant in her former life. Right, she murmured, inspecting her haggard face with detached wonder, straining to recognize the woman she'd known days before. Time to go home. Brad stopped halfway down the stairs, yawning and rubbing sleep from his eyes. The kitchen lights were on. Plates and silverware clattered, and the sweet and savory aroma of pancakes and bacon wafted. He tiptoed into the kitchen, cautiously hopeful, his lips compressed in a contrite, sheepish half-smile. "Rose?" She turned from the skillet and regarded him neutrally. "Hi, babe. Good timing. Breakfast is ready." His place had been set with a knife and fork laid precisely on a napkin, a cup of steaming coffee on the right, and a tall glass of orange juice on the left. "Thank you," he said slowly, perplexed and hesitant as if a sudden move might shatter the harmony. Rose plated the pancakes with a spatula, scooped scrambled eggs in a neat pile beside them, and added the bacon after dabbing grease with a paper towel. She slid the chair out and motioned him to sit with a slow, languid gesture, then took her place opposite her husband and laced her fingers together, elbows on the table. Brad relaxed as he took his first bite and chased it with a sip of coffee. "You're not eating?" She shook her head and watched him. "Listen," he said, swallowing. I'm sorry about the whole thing with Coco. No, it's fine, darling. I always trust you to make the right decision. He nodded to himself and raised the glass of juice. We'll handle it together. We've always been simpatico, don't you think? Like, don't even need to discuss things to agree on them? Of course. Brad took a deep swig and his face contorted. Oh, geez, this tastes weird. As it should. Rose pondered, considering the chemical cocktail she'd added after raiding the top shelf in the basement storage closet. A pinch of drain cleaner, a dash of antifreeze, a teaspoon of the heavy-duty pesticide from the red container with the stern warnings printed under the skull and crossbones symbol. Did you check the expiration date? It's organic, Rose explained, enriched with vitamins, ginseng, and all kinds of things. Brad shook his head. Well, if it's good for me, he mumbled, wincing with another gulp. Rose sat back and waited for the effects, which, according to her research, would be rapidly fatal, delayed at most by minutes. The doorbell jangled, and Brad's face lit up. Rose heard the familiar squeal of doggy door hinges and the rubber flap smack down. Coco trotted into the kitchen, tail knocking against the table legs as he tried to bury his nose in Rose's frozen, splayed hands, but was blocked by the plastic cone attached to his collar. Dean followed, grinning and presenting the dog with a flourish. Ta-da! Brad clapped and stood up. What do you think, Rose? He looks great, right? Doc said it was the quickest recovery he'd ever seen, Dean added. Look at her, man. She's speechless. Well, I wanted it to be a surprise, but you got my messages, right, hon? Brad said, then tenderly touched his stomach with indigestion. A choked gurgle issued from Rose's throat before she found her voice. Messages? Yeah, I had to get rid of all this old food for his new diet. Ordered a bunch of brand new stuff for him. Should be here today. I figured it's just money, right? We'll find a way to make it work. The hole in the backyard, she breathed. Brad was puzzled. Oh, I know. That's why I started clearing space to install the fence. It takes time to dig deep enough for the posts and the back gate, you know. Now he can wander out there all he wants. Coco bounds beneath the table, knocking his cone against the legs. Cute stuff, Dean chuckled. Hey, bro, that pea shooter of yours still jammed? Brad coughed and leaned over the table. The dog whined. You feeling okay, man? Remain in that same Ellery Queen mystery magazine, turning to a story this time by Rebecca Turkowitz, and it's called The Summer People. The camp was perched at the edge of the North Main Woods, its stables and cabins wrapped tightly around the shores of Black Cat Pond like a shawl. The only way in or out was an old narrow logging road. The Hubbard sisters, Bella and Catherine, had come every summer for the past 5 years. At camp, they'd learned to ride horses, steer kayaks, braid their hair into fishtails, and carve deep X's into their mosquito bites to drain the pus. The air was different from how it was in the city, damp and mercurial, with a new smell and texture every hour. The nights were dark, dark. Filled with scuttling noises and tawny moths with furry bodies. The girls had always loved camp. the ache in their limbs after the long full days, the cedar smell of the buildings, the hum of the excitement as the campers exchanged scary stories in the hazy light of the bunkhouse. But now, Catherine was 12 and Bella was almost 11, they were old enough to notice the feigned zealotry of the counselors and feel vaguely guilty about the way the campers treated the greasy-haired cafeteria worker with the bad tooth. They missed the frayed wire, whole body tingling that they used to feel every moment that they did when they were at camp. 3 days before their dad was coming to pick them up in his mud-streaked Honda Civic, the Hubbard sisters waited until the other girls in their bunkhouse were asleep, then crept out into the fragrant night. Catherine carried the big metal flashlight that the girls used to find the lavatory. The sky was dense with clouds, wind was falling from the mountains in great slamming gusts, which the sisters knew meant rain was coming. It was hard to keep quiet and hard to contain the glee and the heart-hammering nervousness that they'd so wanted to reclaim, and which had dutifully returned to them. They plodded with eager but careful steps toward the pond. The sisters had not talked about where they would go, but this seemed like the natural destination. Some lights were still on in the office, and the lavatory windows glowed like a beacon, but when they peered over the rippling expanse of water into the woods, there was a black hole where the world should be. When they arrived at the shores, the groundkeeper's daughter was waiting. They'd seen her splitting wood by the groundkeeper's shed, pulling weeds near the north cabins, and lounging on the dock at dusk, but they never had spoken to her. They didn't understand how she knew they'd be coming. "I didn't," she told them with a sly smile. "Silly." She wore a loose sundress and knee-high waders. Her hair was in a messy braid. In one hand, she held an empty bird's nest, and the flashlight's glare made her skin look very white. She was older than the Hubbard sisters, though maybe not by much. She put up her empty hand to shield her eyes. "Do you mind?" she said, and Catherine lowered the beam. "Where's your light?" Catherine asked, and the groundskeeper's daughter laughed. Catherine blushed beneath her sunburn. It had been a stupid question, though she didn't understand why. "Did you know that someone drowned in this lake?" Bella said quickly. "And now, when she sees a leg dangling over the side of the inner tube, she grabs on with her skeleton fingers and tries to pull herself up." "So I've heard." "Well, we know all the camp ghost stories." "Not all of them," the groundskeeper daughter said. "How would you know?" Catherine pointed the flashlight toward the far shore of the pond, where the grasses seemed to be moving. Then she swept it back toward their feet. "Because camp people never know everything," the groundskeeper daughter said, "even though you always think you do." "Will you tell us?" Bella asked. "It's late, and I don't want to frighten you." "Please," Bella begged, we won't tell the others." The groundkeeper's daughter smiled. The shadowed lines on her face deepened. She tossed the bird's nest into the pond. She sat on the mossy ground and gestured for the Hubbard sisters to do the same. She began. "The property that now held the camp used to be a hunting lodge built for a foolish city man who wanted a place to pretend to be someone he was not. He came to escape New York's sticky heat and stink. He came for years until a hunting party ended in disaster. The forest had decided it wanted the men, his guests, and it hooked its clawed tendrils into them and never let go. The first dead friend was found with his neck torn open and a missing tongue. The next followed the sound of a woman weeping until he plunged headfirst into a gulch. Another had gone off alone and got his foot stuck in a bear trap and had gone mad with thirst and fear. Another claimed to have seen a huge black wing swing out of his wardrobe in the night and then vanished completely. Soon, only the owner was left. He'd turned his gun on himself rather than take those stories back to their wives, now widows in the city. "If everyone died," Catherine said, "how could you know what happened?" "Because it wasn't everyone," the groundkeeper's daughter said, her voice suddenly like the edge of a knife. "There were staff here too, obviously a cook, a guide, women who cleaned and served them food, a groundskeeper." A frog croaked, the dock creaked, a loon called nearby, and the sisters jumped. They grinned at each other in the dark. "Do you know any other stories?" Bella asked. The groundkeeper's daughter did, but the locals kept these stories close to the chest. As a rule, they didn't share them with visitors. But the groundkeeper's daughter liked the Hubbard sisters. She offered, if they wanted, to show them the very spot where the next story took place. Catherine wondered if she should refuse the author for her sister's sake. But then she imagined the winding drive back to the highway and what it would feel like to hold the memory of this evening deliciously in her body while their father complained about the potholes and the crushed bugs streaking the windshield and the failure of the GPS. The groundskeeper daughter stood and helped the girls up. Her hands were sandpapery, and the feel of the rough skin sent little shivers down the sisters' spines. She led them to where the first copse of birch trees marked the entrance of the woods. She took the flashlight from Catherine and then said, "It isn't far. Stay close." The sisters joined hands. The beam of light shone on a wisp of a trail they'd never noticed before, a line of cleared brush so thin it might have been a deer path. They walked. The sisters sensed that they were climbing upwards because the tired muscles of their legs began to complain. The smell changed, became riper, leaf rot, wet moss. They had never thought of worms as having a smell, but that's what it smelled like, worms. Occasionally the branches overhead thinned, and the girls could see the sky. Why were the clouds moving like that? Catherine wondered. As if she was at the bottom of a lake looking up at its rippling surface. The girls' shoes squelched, their ankles itched. They felt the gossamer threads of spider webs break against their bare arms and foreheads, their sunburned cheeks. "I think we should go back now," Catherine said. Then she knocked into the groundskeeper's daughter, who'd stopped moving. "We're here," the groundskeeper daughter trilled, swinging the flashlight toward them and then shutting it off. Just before the light retreated, Bella saw a wooden platform jutting out from a tree. "This is my favorite story," the groundskeeper daughter said, "and I know a lot of stories." A fat drop of rain hit Catherine's forehead, then slid into her eye. She heard the first patter of rain on the maple leaves, open palms. Each sister looked to where she thought her sister's face was in the darkness. "The story begins with two girls. These were good children, though it was hard to say if they were really, truly good, because they had never had cause to be really, truly bad. They were fattened up on soft foods and promising futures and long nights of sleep in locked houses." The groundskeeper's daughter's voice was maybe growing fainter. The wind was maybe growing louder. These two sisters did not know how dark the woods could be when the clouds rolled in and the canopy grew thick overhead. They did not know how the night could be heavy, how it could drag them down. These girls, like all the good children from all the good stories, felt, too late, a tingling sense of wrongness on the backs of their necks. They heard a branch snap, a strange braying, a single unexpected footfall, the flap of a wing. They spun around and found that there was no path behind them, and no path ahead. The rain picked up and the forest filled with a loud, hollow hissing. The Hubbard sisters reached out into the downpour, but they could not, for the life of them, tell which way was forward. They could not tell which way was back. And finally, from the Department of the First Stories, Joel Haskard brings us our final story. It's called A Good Smothering Pillow. Young Peggy McBride found the first minutes of her new employment puzzling. Mr. Robert Blackenwell was a coal baron with a hard reputation in his West Virginia community, yet here he was, personally showing Peggy around his brownstone mansion. Not the lead maid or even his wife, but the great mustached tycoon in the flesh. They seemed to be all alone. "Come here, my dear child." He practically pushed her into hallways and great rooms, making no mention of how much she would be paid to dust and mop, no mention of her hours or which specific rooms to clean. He never showed her a closet or a washroom. Instead, he came across as a giddy museum curator, delighted to have an audience for his varied collections. "Oh, you must see this." He led her into a small room of dark red walnut paneling. It reminded her of the confessional in her grandmother's church. "Now these are fluorescent minerals," Blackenwell stated. "They look plain now, right? But wait until the electrons get excited." He pushed a button on the wall. "There!" Peggy gasped. The rocks lit up, revealing unexpected beauty. Fluorite glowed purple, willemite green, and calcite a shy, wonderful, oh, peach. Chinese water pipes, Philippine daggers, Eskimo slippers, shrunken heads from Ecuador. The tour of the main floor went on and on. Robert Blackenwell walked behind young Peggy McBride and guided her forward, his meaty hands resting on her shoulders. He steered her into a Western-themed room, one wall covered in barbed wire. Each grim strand had a name, and he read aloud his favorites. Necktie, two around two, kangaroo wire, half hitch, Scut's clip. He shook his head, marveling. "Nasty stuff they used out west to keep those little cows in line. Can you imagine getting tangled up in that business?" "No," Peggy said. It was the first she had spoken since their introduction at the vast front doors. Blackenwell gave her an appraising look. "Now tell me about your family." "They work in your mines, my brother and my father." "Ah, well, that is lovely to hear." He clapped his hands. "And do they know that you have come up here today, that you arranged this little opportunity?" "No." They stood in front of the seashell display, both measled cowries and Mr. Blackenwell's grinning down at her. "Fine, fine," he said. "Just fine." The tour went deeper into the mansion. Sloth skulls, mammoth molars, a glass case that held 210 vertebrae from a Cretaceous shark. They look like round toppled dominoes curving in a posture of finality. Peggy took it all in. Mr. Blackenwell had gone on ahead, rubbing his big hands together. This last door leads out to the conservatory. I suppose there might be some time when you... Peggy brought the Maori war club down on his head, again and again. He was on the floor, blood spreading across the tiles, but still alive. He was making gasping sounds, the same kind of sounds her father made as he died of black lung. It was easier than she'd expected, but still the job wasn't done. What a wonderful collection of bric-a-brac you have, Mr. Blackenwell. But there is just one thing I haven't seen yet. She walked leisurely back into the mansion, looking. All right, good and wonderful people, that's going to do it for this episode of The Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying thanks again for joining me, and tune in again next time if you would, please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.